Welcome to the highlights of the Circular Republic Festival, Europe's leading event for advancing the circular economy, uniting corporates, startups, and innovators driving this transformation. We kick off this series with the keynote by Sandrine Dixon de Kleve, co-president of the Club of Rome, and comments from Joseline Blériot, executive lead policy and institutions at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. This conversation is moderated by Niklas Alexander Maus, co-founder of Circular Republic. But before we start, I have an offer for you. If you want to get the actionable one-pager of this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm.
Money opportunity. Now it keeps changing towards supply chain resilience, like the resource aspect becomes more important. Social dimension, maybe that's a little bit call to action for all of us. I think there's a tremendous social dimension of a circular economy. Think of all the informal waste sectors around the world where you can really empower people, lift people out of poverty, where you have to build infrastructure. So I'm somehow not surprised, but I would also give this a little bit as work back to the group. Let's really think about the social dimension of the circular economy as well. So thank you very much for this first mentee. We have more mentees coming up because it's really for us interesting to figure out what's the opinion in the room and want to learn from you. So off to the next one, right? What now we dive next? Into ecology, what nature says. And my big pleasure now, we're going to start this session with a keynote and then enter a panel discussion for the keynote. Big pleasure to welcome virtually with us Sandrine Dixon de Kleve. She has been the co-president of the Club of Rome, the famous institution that basically a little bit more than 50 years ago came up with the limits to growth. I think some of you have read it. Now it's all about Earth for All, and a big pleasure to have Sandrine with us. She's one of the leading forces and global voices in the field of impact. Sandrine, let's check if we can see you and hear you. With us.
Hello, everyone. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Warm welcome. Hello, Sandrine.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm so sorry that I cannot be there in person.
So, but we're happy to have you virtually with us. You are already on a mission somewhere in Europe, on a secret mission. I would say if you're ready, warm welcome at the Circular Republic Festival, and the virtual stage is all yours.
Great. Well, listen, first of all, I very much appreciated the conversations that I've been hearing, in particular the opening from the two fathers, the founding fathers, and also the initiators of this incredible initiative. And what I want to do now is take a step back and really look at some of the triggers of the economy that we're in and try to see how we can really move towards well-being on a finite planet. So this comes back to some of the answers from all of you in terms of how do we actually live in harmony on this planet and take into consideration not only circularity, but a regenerative economy and a well-being economy. And what this means is also a better understanding of the transition from the book that we wrote at the Club of Rome in 1972, The Limits to Growth, which already started to see some of the deep constraints in a continued desire to grow and to grow an extractive economy. So the industrial constraints, the issuing of knowing that we are starting to move outside of an operating space, the deep constraints in terms of our natural resources, but also our food production, etc. To today, where we believe in the work that we've done with Johan Rockström and other scientists and economists around Earth for All, that there is a different way. There's a way to move towards an economy which actually is going to service people, planet, and prosperity at the same time. Now, let's hone in on this. In the 2020s already, we're seeing deep tipping points. Industrial output is starting to go down. Resources are definitely going down. Stress points because of growing population until now, and also food production is going down. Now, this is very important to note, because we're moving from an empty world to a full world. And we know that labor and infrastructure is limiting factors of human well-being. We also know that we actually are moving into a 6 boundaries of our 9 planetary boundaries situation being on overload and surpassed. So we are in a dire situation. And so what does this look like in terms of our systems? Well, first, global resource productivity is declining because of the impacts on our resources, but also the fact that we have overproduced and that we're not optimizing our systems. Hence why circularity becomes so important across the board, but also regenerative ways in which we can bring back into our system a very different way of producing. The compass for human progress and prosperity is clearly problematic for this century. We know that we need to stay within those planetary boundaries. And as the donut indicates, we need to, as a human species, really reduce our resource demand because we have a reduction of resource supply. And we need to link this to basic human needs. We also know that we're at the outer limits, as we've seen, of the planetary boundaries. So how do we actually address the social foundation within the ecological ceiling, which again answers a little bit to the METI of how some of you are thinking about the economy, this link between the ecological constraints, but also the human constraints and the social constraints. And this means that we need to understand what's the fair consumption space. How do we maneuver between overconsumption and underconsumption, knowing that in the global south, there is less consumption in comparison to the global north, that it is the global north that continues actually to have the greatest impact in terms of emissions because we haven't decoupled. And therefore, we need to look at that fair consumption space, the different impacts in terms of the carbon budget, whose needs and desires do we prioritize? How do we eliminate overconsumption while enabling everyone to consume enough to be healthy and safe? And how do we put fairness at the center of our climate debate, but also at the center of our resource debate? So I'm going to bring in a few elephants in the room. This big one is sitting on the couch. And let me show you some of the key areas that I think are really constraining us from moving forward. The first is what I call the morality gap. The fact is that our leadership has forgotten what it means to lead, both in terms of business leaders, but also in terms of policy leaders, that we actually need to take into consideration that wealth distribution is going completely in the wrong way and is leading to insecurity across a variety of socioeconomic areas, but also politically. And there was a bit of that intonation in the opening remarks, that shareholder value in an over-financialized economy is what the focus is, rather than enhancing people's lives and livelihoods through an economy that is circular, regenerative, and functioning towards well-being. That extractive GDP economics is continuing to push overproduction rather than thinking of consumption within that fair space. That because of that, we have deep climate discrimination, again, between the poorest and the richest in our society, whether you look at it geopolitically or whether you look at it within country. And that because of this, there's global well-being decline. And we are not taking into consideration the deep cost of inaction, whether it be in terms of the way in which we're in now 1.5 degrees and the cost of being at 1.5 degrees and moving outside towards 3 degrees, or whether it be the cost of the direct impacts from climate and also from the resource gap. And then finally, what I'm really talking about more and more now is how we have this 5M focus over our heads. The fact that we are now moving towards political spheres and geopolitics that look more like monarchies taking over big pieces of land and moving forward as if ownership is authoritarian rather than properly distributed and diversified, based on very much focusing on money. And that money is tied to the AI revolution, to molecules, to minerals, but also to the military. Those 5Ms are directing, if you look at the way in which geopolitics are playing out, the geopolitical sphere that we need to maneuver today. And this is quite frightening, because if you start to unpack this very quickly, you start to see that those elephants in the room are real, and they are the ones that are determining some of the governance decisions and also the political party shifts that we're seeing today in terms of our democracies. The first is wealth distribution. The poorest 50% take less than 15% in total earnings, while the richest global 10% take well over 40%. And we're seeing this in the global north as well as the global south. But really, that rich disparity, or that disparity between the wealthy and the poorest, is happening the most in the global north. So wealth distribution is really moving in the wrong way. We can see this in the United States, where salaries for CEOs have increased by 1,460% in comparison to employee salaries by 18%. And this really demonstrates that morality gap that I was talking about before. Now, what is that doing? That's creating increased levels of distrust, both in business and in government. We also see that CO2 responsibility of the rich is clearly a problem, because the poorest 50% are responsible for only around 10% of total lifestyle consumption emissions. We have to remember that CO2 emissions are relative to consumption. So we have not decoupled. And even if we move towards circularity, that will not be enough. Hence why we need to address regenerative models and deep economic shifts that will enable us to start to move in the right direction, even though we know that this third elephant in the room, that we are at 1.5 degrees, that this is actually going to have a direct impact on what I call the cost of inaction. Because, ladies and gentlemen, we are in a system that is producing and functioning around productivity at a time when we know that we actually will lose GDP, which is the measure of productivity, consistently, because we are now at 1.5 degrees. The fact is that at 1.5, we lose 3% of GDP globally per annum. And that at 3 degrees, we actually lose upwards of 10% of GDP, and in some countries, in particular in the global south, 17% of GDP. So this is my last big elephant in the room. Global well-being is declining. Through our too little too late scenario that we have produced through Earth for All, we looked at how social tension and global well-being work together. And we saw that the average well-being is actually going down, even though GDP growth has gone up. And this is because of population growth, which has a huge impact on natural resources and production, but also climate change. So what's interesting, however, is that 68% of G20 citizens that we interviewed want a well-being economy. So we're going completely contrary to what actually people want or people's needs. But this comes back to the morality gap of our current leadership. What we need to enhance that well-being shift is to move beyond GDP and to look at new indicators. And this is being done, actually, a lot of work that I've been doing in the European Union, at the OECD, and at the UN, where we start to take into account social and environmental risk and financial and economic decision-making and look at new indicators. And those new indicators are coming from the green growth movement, the post-growth movement, the donut economics proposals, some of the beyond GDP thinking in terms of the broad range of indicators, well-being economics, etc. We're also correcting inequity between high and low income countries created by international finance and trade systems. So looking at the elimination of debt, for example, or special drawing rights. We have to rethink our perspective of global goods and socialize the rewards of environmental and social commons and increase the agency of women and workers, bring them into the real economy. Many of them are out of the real economy. And address that real elephant in the room, which is that we need to now buffer GDP across our economies and think through of a broader indicator base of what truly is a thriving economy. And so what we did was we took that analysis and we actually put it into two scenarios, the too little too late scenario and the giant leap scenario, and realized that if we focused on these five key turnarounds, poverty, empowerment, inequality, food, and energy, we actually could get to a well-being economy. And this is just one of those very complex system dynamic plots that show us how we move from GDP per person all the way to public spending, public sector capacity, labor use, energy and food use. You can look at all the different plots and see how complex it is. But here is the big aha moment, that the speed of action on planetary boundaries is a function of the speed of action on inequality and poverty, which basically means that we have to move from the too little too late scenario to the giant leap scenario, taking into consideration how we bring people on the journey and how do we enhance their lives and livelihoods so they can thrive, not just survive. And what is this going to cost us? 2 to 4% of global income is needed to invest in a better future. And that 2 to 4% is pretty much what we're losing right now because we're not thinking about these things as we are at 1.5 degrees. This would actually enable us to move up the line towards better well-being already starting in 2020. So if we had already applied this in the 2020s, but we can start to see that shift in 2030 and beyond, and it would allow us to reduce social tension. Just a couple more slides and I'm almost finished. The critical feedback loop then is how do we ensure that the planetary boundaries work and that we stay within the planetary boundaries, within also ensuring that we bring inequality down and poverty down so that we address the level of social tension, that we look at public action, that we really address food and energy shifts, and definitely as well the role of materials and then the level of inequality and poverty. What we did with Janusz Potocznik, who will actually close this conference for you, when he was commissioner and after being commissioner in his work with Systemic and myself at the Club of Rome, is start to translate this into what it means with regard to policymaking, what it means in terms of moving beyond just the focus on circularity, but also redefining prosperity, redefining natural resource use, redefining progress, thinking through then the designing and the implementation so we have the right metrics, understanding what competitiveness means in the 21st century through smart prosperity, redefining the types of incentives that we need from a social and natural capital perspective. What does consumption mean from owning to using? So again, looking at consumption and demand mechanisms, redefining finance, governance, and leadership. And this was very important as it also enabled us to think about what we call Industry 5.0. And this is some of the work that I've been doing and that I did when I chaired actually one of the expert groups for DG Research and Innovation. And this is my last slide, because Industry 5.0 is a new industrial prowess for the 21st century. It takes into consideration regenerative, circular, and economic by design. It is an industry that needs to be both self-sustaining and adaptive and less fragile, so resilient to future shocks and stresses. It is also an industry that's decentralized to achieve resilience and sustainability. Digitalized with purpose to live within the planetary boundaries, not just to promote the AI revolution or to think about becoming a billionaire, because hopefully that is not all of your purposes, but actually it's to try to profit, but by the same token, ensure that you're making sure that you're making those profits within the constraints of the planetary boundaries and that you're thinking about social impacts. Measuring what matters means regenerative metrics and regulatory frameworks. It has to be human-centric, responsible at the value chain and at the ecosystem level. So, ladies and gentlemen, this festival is fundamental, but the fundamentals also have to go back up the value chain towards consumption. When we talk about circularity, we really have to think about how we shift our consumption patterns and how we move beyond growth. We know that this is the decisive decade. We know that there's too much bad news to justify complacency, but there's too much good news to justify despair, as Dana Meadows, one of the authors of The Limits to Growth, said. But also we know, and this is what I delivered on Wall Street when we released Earth for All, uncontrollable growth and an over-financialized economy will crowdfund disaster. Many of us are seeing the signs of that encroaching disaster, But we can stop it by working together collaboratively, as some of the other presenters said before. I will stop sharing, and I look forward to having a discussion with all of you.
Thank you very much, Sandrine. I was looking into the audience. There might be one or two people who are thinking about being a billionaire, not looking at anybody specific. Thank you very much for sharing all the big elephants in the room. I think there's a lot of food for thought now. You will be with us for our discussion. And for this, my pleasure to welcome on stage Jocelyn Blériot. He's the executive lead for policy and institutions at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. And the session will be moderated by Niklas Alexander Maus. Back on stage.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you back
again.
Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Joss, thank you so much for being here, and Sandrine, thanks a lot for all these insights that you brought with you. It's an incredible honor to have both of you here. Joss, as really one of the key figures behind the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, you've been with the foundation for more than a decade, driving circularity globally, and Sandrine, you've been introduced everything you do at the Club of Rome, and now as executive head at Earth for All. It's an incredible honor to have you, as said. Sandrine, you've mentioned it in the beginning. You would have been here personally. No one heard that, I have to tell you, because everyone was applauding to you. So maybe I'll just simply repeat what the reason is for you only being with us virtually. You've been called into a UN board, as far as I understand, by Antonio Guterres personally. That's what hindered you from coming here. And I think Antonio Guterres is the only legitimate excuse not to be physically here at the Circular Republic Festival. So all
well,
the better.
It's more Simon Steele at the climate level, but still very important. It's the UNFCCC new high-level panel on COP reform.
Sandrine, you've brought a couple of striking insights here, and also some sobering insights, I think. Some things that also me personally, I in my daily life, even though dealing with circularity from morning to evening, don't really have on my agenda, to be honest. Jocelyn, now that you're with us, what Sandrine has been mentioning would you underscore, and what would you also like to add from your EMF perspective?
Oh God, where do I start? As usual with you, Sandrine, it was extremely rich and thought-provoking. I'm very happy, first of all, to be here. Ellen MacArthur Foundation has been working in the background with a few of you here, with Matisse, with Suzanne in the days of Acatech, in the early days of sustainability through circular economy at German level. We've done obviously a lot of work with Systemic, with Martin Schuchtei. So all that ecosystem is a bunch of friends, really, which is great. But at the same time, we need to expand that circle, because we bump into each other, and that's lovely. But we need more people involved in the transformation. And that's what the Circular Republic and the festival can actually bring and catalyze. So where to start? Well, perhaps one figure struck me, actually, Sandrine, in your presentation, which was the 2-4% of global revenue that needs to be invested in order to get us to a better scenario, which for me is in massive contrast with a figure by the International Monetary Fund that says that 7% of global GDP in 2022 was allocated to fossil fuel subsidies. So almost double of what we need is invested in getting us in the exact opposite direction, which means that actually one of the biggest things when it comes to circular economy is not so much does it make sense. Is it sound? Would it get us there? Do the numbers stack up? Do people want it? It's actually, does it even stand a chance in the current economic model? Because it actually favors linearity. The economic system, the cost and incentive structure of the economy, is hardwired for and by linearity. And what business tells us, the ambitious, the pioneering businesses of the circular economy that we've been working with for 15 years, are saying to us today, we've picked the low-hanging fruits of circular economy. And by that, they mean what was possible to do in a linear-focused model in terms of circularity, we've done it. So our contention is not so much that we need a bigger ladder, we need to lower the branches. It doesn't need to be a bigger effort for circular economy to be that. It needs to become the norm. It needs to become within arm's reach. And that is really about looking at what we incentivize, what we tax, fiscal policy. You know, if we're serious about going into the decade of implementation, it's not about nice perspectives and good models and what if, and it could bring that. We actually have to look at the really difficult political questions that are on the table. Otherwise, we won't get to scale. And now it's a question of scale. The idea of a circular economy is accepted. 75 roadmaps globally. By our accounts, about 50 to 60% of global businesses have an element of circularity in their strategies. How do we get to scale now?
Maybe taking one step back and looking into like the history also of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation throughout the last years. The foundation was founded in 2009, if I'm not mistaken.
Ten.
Okay. Fine. You've been with them since 2012, right?
No, I was part of the team that
you've been part from the start. Yeah. Okay. You mentioned it partly. What has changed in terms of awareness, but also in terms of the whole narrative all around the circular economy throughout that time? You said everyone has understood it. Sometimes I would challenge that. I say that myself. It's not a matter of awareness anymore. It's a matter of execution. But then sometimes you leave the bubble and you're sort of down to square one.
I'm not sure I said accepted. I think I haven't said understood. I've said accepted,
okay.
Which is a bit of a different thing. Because you can accept it if you understand, for instance, that it's a question of better waste management or recycling, which is too often the case, and that's one of the issues. But I would say if you look at really the early days of circular economy, the first real incarnation of the concept was in Chinese policy, 2008, the Circular Economy Promotion Law. It was about securing supply base of the Chinese economy that was growing very fast. When it came to Europe, thanks to Janusz Potocznik mostly, actually, through the European Resource Efficiency Platform, it was also a question of securing the European supply base. So it wasn't, to begin with, an ecological agenda at all. It became one because it was very closely associated with the European Green Deal, and it was a pillar of the Green Deal. And I think that what we're going back to now is a narrative that is focused on resilience, security of supply, material sovereignty, food sovereignty, you name it, due to a series of shocks. And so, in a way, the good news is that all these arguments and the economic and the environmental and the resilience arguments were already there. We have to, I think, make an even better economic case because there are also political headwinds, and anything that is seen as remotely environmental or green is too easily pitched as anti-business. We've seen it as the last year with the debate around the nature restoration law in the EU, which almost died. And actually, you could argue that it's half dead, but at the very least, it's still there. It's gutted out, it's hollow, but it still does exist. And if it hadn't been for a number of really vocal private sector actors that said, you're not getting this, you're destroying the ecosystem in which the economy lives, then we wouldn't even have one. So the private sector advocacy for circular economy is much more important than it was 5 years ago, because that's the only way to really keep it on the map as a pathway for development which is sound, reasonable, and ecologically compatible.
Generally, I think you can even choose among what is your favorite motivation to go circular. It can be the plain geopolitics, it can be really a genuine ecological agenda. There's lots of reason to go there, and they're not even like mutually exclusive. But clear is that still, and you've mentioned that also, both of you basically, that the overall, if we're looking at the macroeconomic level, the cost and incentive structures still favor the linear model in comparison to the circular one. And now if we look into your graphs, Sandrine, the diagrams, what would you say is the one, it's probably a stupid question, but what is the one major lever to change that overall all framework condition in order to then allow for the changes on the business level?
So first of all, I fully agree with what Jos has just said. And I'm so sorry I'm not there with you, dear friend, on the platform, because it would be really lovely to be there with you. I think that one of the key levers is our dependency on an extractive high carbon economy. And we've seen over the last 2 years now, but especially this past year, that systematically companies have pulled back from their net zero positions, in particular the oil and gas companies that have actually moved completely away from their net zero targets. They've pulled out of SBTI. And so I really do think that there is an affront right now in terms of the incumbents holding on with their dear lives to the existing extractive economy. And unless both shareholders, but also our financial system and our governance system, don't see that this is the most unresilient way to continue forward, then we are actually going to be hitting our heads against a wall. And I do find that incredibly troubling. We've been talking forever. The G20, the G8 have been talking about reducing subsidies and eliminating subsidies for fossil energy. It's not happening. Vios is exactly right, but the 7% of GDP that's going into continuing to prop up a fossil energy economy is incredibly problematic, because it does not enable us to become more circular in a variety of ways. I would also say, and I would turn you all to the new data that's coming out, both from the IEA, but also from other analysts that are saying that actually we're not transitioning in terms of our energy resources. We are investing in renewables less than we ever have and upping the game in terms of investing in brown energy. So this probably would be one of the first key levers to shift. The second is to ensure that we move beyond productivity as the clear main indicator of GDP growth. Unless we do that, I think we will again continue to only focus on productivity and start to have those real impacts on GDP growth coming from all the externalities that we're not taking into consideration.
Looking into basically global cooperation also, because that is something we can only solve, I guess, on the political level globally. At the same time, surely also on the national agendas, who would you say is right now in an active driving role in the global arena? And have you gotten more optimistic or less throughout the last couple of years that we're actually progressing toward where you are sketching a future?
Sadly, I've become less optimistic. I really think that last year, and as Jos said, also with the European Green Deal on a European front, but also with the Biden administration, we were starting to make huge progress. I think that now with the Trump administration, we're back to not only business as usual, but worse than business as usual. As I indicated, those five key M's are what is driving our geopolitics. And that means burn, baby, burn, extract as much as possible. It's also creating a flurry then of counteractivity in terms of measuring our competitiveness based on the American model. And this is a disaster. So rather than Europe actually coming together around a real social and environmental value base to continue to push its entrepreneurial activity, its innovation, and also its policy making, we're seeing exactly as Jos said, that it's actually now moving backwards. We saw it with the Nature Restoration Law. It's going to happen now with the omnibus and the reporting requirements. We all know they need to be simplified, but now we're actually going to probably completely scrap them, which means no value chain, deep value chain data will be out there in terms of understanding whether our industries are truly innovating towards circularity or also innovating towards green, which is very problematic, because how are banks going to invest in the right things if they're not given all access to data? So we need to figure out how we continue to report in a way that optimizes our economy. I'm really quite concerned. I really am.
Jos, what about you?
Yeah, of course. Maybe a note of let's try to be positive and optimistic still, because we have to, because that's what we're doing. First of all, on the political headwinds and the fact that a lot of companies are walking away from those either ambitions or statements, what we've seen in our network, and we work with quite a lot of big private sector actors, they came to us and said, what we'll do is not talk about it anymore. It doesn't mean that we've dropped them. And actually, especially to be concrete in the context of the UN Plastics Treaty, for instance, a lot of companies that had big statements, big commitments to move to either reuse models or substitution of materials or reduction of single-use plastics have said, look, we won't make a big noise about it anymore for various reasons, because actually it attracts a lot of negative publicity on us, and it's counterproductive in a way to have to go and defend those things. We'd rather do them covertly. So, of course, some will say that as an excuse. We don't really know, but it was quite heartwarming to be approached by a lot of the companies that we work with who say, don't worry, we're still doing this. We're not talking about it for tactical reasons, but we're doing it, we're committed. So that's a good thing. The second thing is looking at the ecosystem that we're in right now. We have to have faith in the startup. We have to have faith in a lot of the circular economy native companies. The ones that don't have to change their model from linear to circular, which takes all the resources of a company in some cases, but the people who are working on, and to your point, Sandrine, transparency, traceability, digital product passport, digitally enabled solutions to know what's in the market. Because one of the big issues of the linear model is that you have a problem of feedstock. The stuff that gets put on the market, in most cases, there's too much of it, and it's the wrong stuff. If you don't know that, if you don't have the data, it's just a pile of stuff, and then you spend all your money cleaning up. That's the best-case scenario. Or you implement schemes that amount to absolutely nothing in terms of upstream design measures, etc. And actually, you mentioned EPR earlier. EPR is great, but EPR currently implemented is only a way to get companies to pitch in to clean up a bit. It doesn't change the business practices. So all of that, you know, researching new materials, digital product passports, all these young companies that are starting, get them to scale as urgently as possible. This is what's going to shift the dial, because we're in a bit of a transition scenario where the industrial heritage, which is a long time coming, has created a layer of standards, regulation, logistical change, investment, policy, etc. So sometimes we used to hear, oh, now we know that there's a circular opportunity, let's go there. Or actually, as if it was a choice between two blank pages. No. One is 200 years of history and practices. The other one has to be invented and invested in. And that's the mission of the gatherings that we're here today for.
Exactly. And I totally underscore that. We see in this ecosystem exactly that phenomenon, that we have both large businesses and, of course, many, many really trailblazing startups that lead the way, even within today's framework conditions, but they are convinced this is the right way. The big corporates also in small, medium, large projects going there out of conviction, but also because they are convinced that case will work on the long run also economically, because also otherwise it's not going to work. It's not philanthropy, circularity. Circularity has to be a business case. And I think we see many, many examples, and we're also going to see them all around in this festival, that really show that you, by capturing the value of products, materials, and so on, preserving the value, that you can actually also create that change within already the existing framework conditions, even though maybe in the best case they will also change on the long run. Maybe one conviction from my side and a question to both of you also, feel free to criticize. I absolutely count myself in with all those others in here that say, or not everyone does, but some definitely do, let's get rich by saving the world. Sandrine, that partly doesn't fit to what you've been saying in terms of wealth distribution and so on. What would you say? Is let's get rich by saving the world something probably many entrepreneurs are also having as a notion for themselves? Is that what will lead us in the right direction, or is that something that's actually not really understood the way to go?
No, I'm sorry. I'm going to be very honest. I hate that phrase. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Palo Alto, where the most wealthy actually got rich by not saving the world. I think that there needs to be a deeper understanding of what it means, first of all, to get rich and why. Rich for what? For what purposes? It's really interesting. I didn't show you actually the graph, but life satisfaction doesn't go up when you make more money. It like tapers off at about 100,000. So all those billionaires that keep on going for more, 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 it's not necessarily making them happier, and it's definitely not creating the economic model that we need that will enable more people to thrive. But I would also say, and this is exactly what I said on Wall Street, is that, you know, there is no money on a dead planet. And getting rich by saving the world means that you have to think much more about wealth distribution. So if the question is whether a billionaire is really then thinking about proper redistribution, then yes, I would say, okay. But I do think it's incredibly naive to think that by making tons of money and by somehow putting out products that are actually going to enable change without thinking about the actual model that continues to overproduce, that continues to be extractive, that continues to not think about proper wealth distribution, which is going to create the social tension and is going to continue to mean that actually overall, you might be doing well in your little bunker, but the rest of the world is out rioting, is not going to make your life better. Now, of course, those tech bros in the United States have all built their bunkers, and that's what they're doing. But if any of you walk through the streets of San Francisco, I plea you to open up your eyes and understand what's really happened in a place that I called home, which was where the American dream was thriving. It has become the American nightmare, where we have the highest rate of homelessness, the highest rate of drug addiction. We call it Poop Town now, and this is not Calcutta. And we've got people jumping out of Ubers, going in and stealing up to $1,000 because there's a new law which allows them to steal because we want to keep them out of prison, but we don't want to take care of giving them a home and giving them some level of security. There is something absolutely dysfunctional about this model.
Yeah. Yeah, I fully subscribe to that, and we could be here a long time, and I see the clock's running out. So I would say, well, first of all, personally, you know, I work for an NGO, so chances of me getting rich are about zero, right? I would be doing something else if that was the motivation. The second thing is, the only way that we should be looking at this is we forget that the economy should be at the service of society and not the other way around. And if you can contribute to that in any way you can, and if you make money in the process, I have no issues with that, as long as you don't perpetuate the extractive, linear way of looking at resources and siphoning all the means in the economy in order to safeguard what, actually? Just an idea of success and comfort? That doesn't really help, I think.
Fine. Yep.
I was just going to say, read Andre Hoffman's The New Nature of Business, who says the same thing. It's not about what wealth you bring, but how you integrate the new thinking of wealth across your business proposal while you're making your money. So it's how you make your money, not what you do with your money at the end of it. This notion of just setting up a foundation that's going to make you feel better because you actually made your money the wrong way is not the way to go. So think about a much more integrated approach across your value chain and the way in which you work.
But that is, by the way, exactly what I'm saying, right? I want to get rich by saving the world. I don't want to save the world after having gotten rich. And I think that is the core. It needs to be integrated into the core business model. That's what my notion would be. Because otherwise, in this current system, definitely, it's not going to scale. And it needs to scale by itself, because then it will also create that impact. But time is up. I'm really sorry. I think we could leave this on forever. We're going to be continuing precisely that discussion, maybe, or at least in parts, in the upcoming panel, which is precisely about economy and bringing this whole thing on the company level. Because that's the thing. We have those companies operating in today's world, and they need to navigate the change. And I think that's exactly what we'll be hearing in a minute from now. Thank you so much, Sandrine. Thank you. Thank you so much, Joss.
Thank you. Good to see you, Sandrine.
Thank you. The same. Take care.
Thank you. Thanks. Wow, wow, wow. What a panel discussion and keynote. That was for sure some real talk. But that's pretty much why we're here, right? We don't want to hear the soft versions. We want to hear the naked truth. And thank you so much for that, Sandrine and Joycelyn, and of course, Nicholas, for moderating it through. As Nicholas said, we'll now be jumping into the next panel discussion.
This was the first episode in our series about the Circular Republic Festival 2025. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. Let's drive a profitable circular economy. And please don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.